It's Tuesday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a military logistics agreement between the United States and India is still to be finalized. Belgium charges two more suspects in connection with last month's attacks in Brussels. We talk with a terror analyst.
The Paris attacks from last November are blamed almost exclusively on Brussels, not on the French, because this was a ring that was coordinated out of Molenbeek neighborhood.
And we hear about the success of an all-female band in Ivory Coast. It's all ahead. Belgian prosecutors said Tuesday they've charged two more people in connection with the attacks last month in Brussels that killed 32 people. A statement from the federal prosecutor's office identified the suspects as Ismail F. and Ibrahim F., saying they were linked to renting an apartment that may have been used as a safe house by one of the Brussels bombers. The attacks involved a pair of suicide bombings at Brussels Airport and another bombing at a metro station in Brussels. Police have also arrested six other people, including one linked to the November attacks in Paris that killed 130 people. Belgian prosecutors said the Brussels attackers were planning to hit France again, but decided to launch a quick attack on Brussels after the arrest of key Paris suspect Salah Abdeslam. I spoke with Michael Weiss, the co-author of the book ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, and senior editor of The Daily Beast. He's also non-resident fellow at the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. I asked him about the concerns involving Belgian authorities following the recent attacks in Brussels and Paris.
The Paris attacks from last November are blamed almost exclusively on Brussels, not on the French, because this was a ring that was coordinated out of the Molenbeek neighborhood. Mohamed Belkay, one of the guys who was killed in the raid that captured Abdeslam, was on the phone in real time coordinating the attacks from a foreign city. So, yeah, I mean, if there's a learning curve and they're beginning to sort of get ahead of it a bit, that is to be welcomed. But I have to say, I mean, it wasn't very inspiring in the weeks after the Brussels attack. You know, you saw this dragnet for the man in the white jacket and the dark hat. They caught the wrong guy, but not before accusing him of being a jihadi nightmare or monster or something. Then they had to let him go because they didn't have sufficient evidence. So one hopes that things will improve. But look, this has been a problem for the Europeans for decades, even before 9/11. They have just now, the New York Times has a very good profile of a guy whose nickname is Papa Noel or Santa Claus, who is a veteran, kind of a hybrid gangster jihadist. I think he had fought in the Soviet-Afghan War, came back living in Brussels for decades and radicalizing, proselytizing, turning young sort of lumpen elements from the Muslim diaspora in Brussels into, you know, these international criminals, sending them to Syria, giving them cash disbursements to travel to the caliphate, even though this guy wasn't even employed. He was arrested about a year ago or last summer, I think, and is now on trial. But how is this guy operating in plain sight for so long? He was known to everybody. He radicalized Abdelhamid Abaoud, who was he's called the mastermind, but really more the ringleader of the Paris attacks. He has radicalized a lot of these sort of fellow travelers and affiliates of the ISIS network in Brussels, and was known to law enforcement for years. But they just let him live there. This is the issue that Europe has. I am a little more confident and inspired about the American scene because we don't have this problem, at least not yet. This is much more of an integrated society. Muslims here are not alienated, they are active members of law enforcement, their communities. I mean, they graduate police officers. There are people working in the intelligence services here who come from Arab Muslim backgrounds. And people here are not so afraid to drop a dime on somebody who might be up to no good building, you know, tinkering with fertilizer in his mom's basement next door.
But that's not to say, though, that here in the U.S., people keep saying recently, well, Europe, there's a lot of danger. But there's still got to be a certain amount of threat here in the United States, maybe not as high as it is in Europe, but there still is one.
It's of a different nature. It's the lone wolf phenomenon. People who will be radicalized by imbibing the ISIS ideology remotely, but not necessarily trained up by ISIS and dispatched back to North America. I mean, there are a lot of factors that feed into that. Number one, of course, is geography. I mean, we're separated by an ocean. You can't drive from Raqqa to Washington, D.C. or New York City. You can drive theoretically, from Raqqa to Brussels or to Paris. Right? I mean, Abdeslam lived in a safe house for 4 months for, you know, that was literally one block away from his childhood home. Well, how does that happen unless people were aware he was being domiciled there? I mean, I don't believe that, that he was unknown to the locals. Of course he was.
I had talked to one security expert who was saying that officials really had lost control. I mean, this is kind of what he said of Molenbeek, which I find, you know, hard to believe in a Western European city.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is the sort of central irony of this all, isn't it? I mean, this is the capital of Europe. It's the headquarters of NATO, the headquarters of the European Union and its affiliate institutions. And there are areas that are, in effect, colonial outposts of a third world theocracy, or at least that are behaving as such. And I think that underscores the real problem here. I mean, the Europeans, as I say, I mean, they've been dealing with this before 9/11 and certainly after 7/7, which and the Madrid bombings. The consensus was, we needn't worry. It's never going to be a 9/11 or even 7/7 style attack. It's not going to be this combination gun and bomb attacks, coordinated metro or bus bombings. You know, the worst case we'll see is the Lee Rigby episode, you know, somebody who will get stabbed or shot or, you know, God forbid, beheaded in the street, but not, it's not going to be spectacular. Well, I mean, Paris was, what, 9, 10 coordinated assault rifle and suicide bombings in different parts of the city. Brussels, you had bombers at the airport, bombers at the metro, also coordinated, using not all that sophisticated explosive materials, but still stuff that one had to be trained up on, TATP. You know, so I think there's people have been living a kind of fantasy.
Michael Weiss, he's the co-author of the book ISIS Inside the Army of Terror and senior editor at the Daily Beast and non-resident fellow at the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. Now it's time to look at social media, and I'm joined by editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, the top trend today is Equal Pay Day. Now, today, April 12th, is the day on which women will have earned the same amount for men the previous year. So women earning from January 1st, 2015 through April 12th, 2016 have made the same amount as men for just 2015. So this is a way to highlight some of the wage gaps around the world between men and women, women making less than men. Now, you have people on social media that are saying this isn't really a good indicator because you're not comparing specific jobs or specific careers where there may be more equality. And in fact, a number of tech companies, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, are now announcing that they pay their men and women equally after being years of pressure to do so. Other people are saying, however, on social media that this is highlighting education gaps, career gaps, that maybe more women aren't in technology fields and engineering, so that even though they're not necessarily comparing the fields individually, it's talking about these broader trends. But the fact, I think, that they're debating this issue is good news for a lot of these advocates, and they're happy to see this debate on social media.
Mm-hmm. What else is trending?
Well, we have Yuri Gagarin is trending because April 12th, 1961, 55 years ago, he became the first human in space. So lots of pictures being shared of that momentous journey, some little video clips from way back when, from what little video they had back then of that space travel. But a lot of people talking on social media about how far we've come in the 55 years since. Now, when Yuri Gagarin went into space, it was in the midst of the space race, the Cold War, the U.S. battling the USSR. Well, today you have the U.S. and Russia, and we're cooperating in space and the International Space Station. So that's not lost on people on social media, saying, look how far we've come in these 55 years. We're cooperating now on space, and it's benefiting really both countries and the world.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA. This is Science in a Minute.
If you're an expectant mom and you want your baby to grow into a physically active adult, a new study suggests that you'll need to exercise regularly and stay physically active throughout your pregnancy. Scientists at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas picked a number of genetically identical female mice that enjoyed running. The mice were split into two groups. One group was allowed access to running wheels during their pregnancy, while the others were denied that privilege. The Baylor team found that mice born to mothers who exercised throughout their pregnancy wound up being 50% more physically active than those born to less active mothers. The researchers later found that the physically active youngsters continued to be energetic into adulthood. Several groups of experts already recommend that women who are pregnant without any complications get at least 30 minutes moderate exercise every day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an all-women band from Ivory Coast gets international fans. The Afghan Taliban has announced the start of its annual warm weather fighting season. The country's former hardline Islamic rulers issued a statement Tuesday calling this year's campaign Operation Omari in honor of Mullah Muhammad Omar, whose death in 2013 the Taliban only revealed last year. The group vowed to carry out large-scale attacks against government strongholds through suicide bombings, as well as attacks on NATO troops still deployed in Afghanistan. Ben Berry is a retired British brigadier and the senior fellow for land warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He spoke with me about the Taliban's pronouncement.
It would be in accordance with their previous behavior, because winter is now turning into spring in Afghanistan. There was, certainly in the later part of last year, there was less of a reduction of Taliban activity than previously. You know, maybe they were seeking to press their advantage with the Afghan forces, and also that their new leader, Mullah Mansour, was seeking to establish his authority over the force.
Yeah, now this comes just in recent days. Over last weekend, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, you know, set off an attack, which it did not affect him, but they said that was in response to his visit.
Yes, well, they would do, wouldn't they? I mean, I don't think we should read anything special into that.
They've made a point of, you know, naming this after the late Mullah Omar. Is there any special significance in that, or is this just to honor him?
Yeah, I think it's that. You know, there are plenty of examples of armed forces naming offensives after famous victories or famous leaders. I mean, it may also be an attempt by Mullah Mansour to reinforce his legitimacy, because you could argue his legitimacy was knocked when it was revealed last year that Mullah Omar had in fact been dead for 2 years.
As far as you know, I mean, as far as outsiders would know, has Mullah Mansour been able to consolidate his leadership of the Taliban?
Well, I think there's little doubt that he has done. And indeed, you know, the temporary fall of Kunduz last fall, you know, would have been a great boost to his leadership.
That is Ben Berry. He's Senior Fellow for Land Warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Well, a debate here in the United States over differences between religious beliefs and individual rights shows no signs of flagging. Laws seen as undermining LGBT rights in several southern states have sparked protests and boycott threats from businesses and entertainers, as well as contrary demonstrations by conservatives. Hundreds of people gathered in Raleigh, North Carolina, near the governor's offices in a local landmark that formerly was the state capitol building to support the state's so-called bathroom bill Monday. Signs declaring no men in women's bathrooms emphasize a point in the new law that has drawn wide support among state residents who hold conservative political views. On a nearby sidewalk, meanwhile, a smaller crowd of about 100 people stage a counter-protest. Their chants, "Bigotry is bad for business." They're preaching hate and they don't represent our state. Well, those calls were drowned out by a larger group opposed to extending equal rights protections to people who are transgender, according to a reporter for the Associated Press, who was on the scene Monday. North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory signed into law last month an order that bathrooms or locker rooms in public schools, agencies, and universities must be designated for use only by people based on their biological sex at birth. Transgender people would only be entitled to use bathroom facilities matching their preferred gender identity if they have had their birth certificates legally changed to reflect their transition from male to female or the reverse. Transgender people are often described as individuals who have acquired the physical characteristics of the opposite sex or present themselves in a way that does not correspond with their sex at birth. The new North Carolina law prohibits city and local governments from separately establishing local regulations seen as accommodations to transgender people. And now an interesting news from China. Well, an emotional advertisement about leftover women in that country has gone viral, uncovering not only society's deep-rooted discrimination against single women, but also, analysts say, the Chinese government's failure to tackle gender inequity issues. The four-minute-long documentary-style video, part of Japanese cosmetic giant SK-II's global campaign to inspire women to change their destiny, has resonated with many unwed Chinese women over the age of 27, bringing out their fear of being stigmatized as shengnu, or leftover women. In China, women are conventionally viewed as having an incomplete life if they remain unwed and often are pressured into marrying in their 20s. But on the social media site Weibo, where the video was viewed tens of thousands of times in just a few days, there were more encouraging words than harsh criticism about leftover women. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at The Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. For nine young female artists in Ivory Coast, breaking into the country's male-dominated music industry wasn't easy. But their group, Bellamondo, is now a household name in Abidjan and is booking shows abroad. Emily Iob has the story from the Ivorian capital.
The nine women of Bellamondo win over yet another audience at this bar in Abidjan. This was the first venue to book them years ago, and they still play here weekly. Bellamondo is one of the few all-female ensembles in Ivory Coast. It all started back in 2007 when a music producer came to then-music student Prisca Alou. She says the man told her he wanted to create an all-female band to fulfill a promise he made to his late mother. He says she kept telling him he should showcase women making music, not just men. So Alou spread the word she was looking for band members and placed ads in local papers. She says parents resisted the idea. They would say they didn't send their daughter to school to have her go play guitar on the street. Being a musician was frowned upon for girls. She says in Africa, a woman's place is often seen as being either in an office or at home. That was a stereotypical image. Most of the girls Alou managed to recruit weren't professional musicians. The group spent the next 4 years learning to play their instrument. Many gave up, but eight of them soldiered on with Alou, and the band was born. Soon they began performing together, playing covers and original songs. Their musical style is best described as variété. The band dabbles in funk, reggae, and pop music. Guitar player Clotilde Blay says many didn't believe the band would last. People will tell us that women can't make it work, that they can't get along together, she says. So we took that as a challenge. One they have met. In 2013, Bellamondo released their first album, and over the years they have performed at galas, official dinners, and on stages in Europe and West Africa. No nodding his head to the music during a live performance in Abidjan is music enthusiast Kader Nanema. He remembers the first time he saw them.
Ah ouais, j'étais surpris.
I was surprised at first, he says. A woman singing, you see that every day. But an entire band with just women playing all the instruments, that was extraordinary. I was dumbstruck, he says. The band is great and the girls are top-notch. Alou believes Belamondo inspired other women to push social barriers. Today, she says, when I go out, I'm proud to see young women carrying a guitar, a keyboard or a drum around. And I know that we have played a role in this. She says, we gave other women the desire to do this and it makes me very proud. The Belamondo are currently preparing their second album. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
Belamondo, very popular sound there in Abidjan and also elsewhere. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorism is insidious. In many cases, covert operatives of extremist groups attempt to infiltrate societies they view as their enemies and exploit established networks and institutions, such as the global banking or communications systems, to plan and execute acts of terrorism in an effort to further their nefarious goals. If we are to be successful in fighting this scourge, these operatives must be exposed and locked out of the global financial and other systems. From time to time, the United States identifies individuals who are crucial to the operation or specific agenda of a terrorist organization. Most often, these are part of the leadership or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Occasionally, the designated individual is already in custody. That is the case with 26-year-old Salah Abdeslam, who was designated by the U.S. Department of State and named a specially designated global terrorist on April 5th, 2.5 weeks after his arrest in Brussels, Belgium. A Belgian-born French national, Abdeslam, an operative of ISIL, was deeply involved in last year's terrorist attack on Paris that killed 130 people and injured 350 others. Identified by witnesses as the driver of a car full of gunmen that went on to stage murderous attacks at a number of restaurants in Paris, Abdeslam admitted that he had later changed his mind about detonating a suicide bomb near the Stade de France sports stadium, where a soccer game was in progress. His DNA was found on a discarded suicide belt there, as well as in a Brussels apartment, where another suspected terrorist was killed in mid-March. Abdeslam is believed to be the only survivor from the terrorists who participated in the attack on Paris. A terrorism designation can expose and isolate organizations and individuals engaged in terrorism. As a result of this designation, all property subject to U.S. jurisdiction in which Abdeslam has any interest is blocked, and U.S. persons are prohibited from engaging in any transactions with Abdeslam. By naming Salah Abdeslam a specially designated global terrorist, the United States freezes any holdings or bank accounts he may have, effectively preventing his fellow conspirators from using such funds to support ISIL's deadly agenda.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.